Well, as you know, over these last couple of years, at intervals, we've been singing our way through the Book of Psalms. Tonight we've just sung Psalm 53, which is headed to the choir master, according to Mahalath, a maskil of David. This psalm is very similar to a psalm we sang some time ago, Psalm 14. In fact, there are only a few words that are different between Psalms 14 and Psalms 53. I've not looked back to see what I said about Psalm 14, and to be honest, I can't remember at all. If I did look back, I might find that tonight I'm largely repeating myself, or I might find that I'm saying completely different things, hopefully not contradictory things, but at least fresh things. In this psalm, David is looking at the world in which he lives, or rather, David is telling us what God sees when he looks at the world in which we live. What does God see? God sees a world that is determined not to believe in him. David pictures a man in verse 1. A man who says in his heart, there's no God. He tells himself that there's no God. It's not just that that's his instinctive assumption. Rather, he's reassuring himself that there's no God. He's persuading himself that there's no God. When David talks about such a man, is he talking only about a few people in the world? Are there just a few people in the world who say, no God? The handful of people who belong to the National Secular Society, or the British Humanist Association, or who finance the Richard Dawkins Foundation. Are those the people he's talking about here in this psalm, or whatever the ancient equivalent would be of those groups of people? People who say that there is no intelligent being apart from the physical creatures that live on this earth, maybe on other planets. That's what we mean when we talk about an atheist today. We talk about somebody who says material reality is all there is. There is no being of any sort that moves in any other realm. The only creatures that exist are the creatures that can be seen through telescopes and can be examined through microscopes. So today there's that small number of people who say quite flatly there are no gods, no goddesses, no spiritual entities, no angels, no demons, there are simply no powers apart from physical powers. There are no divinities at all. There is nothing outside of this world to which we should look in worship. Is that who David is talking about when he talks about the fool who says no God? Is he just talking about the atheist in the modern sense? The person who says there's nothing beyond this world. There's nothing, there's nobody out there beyond this world at all. If so, he's talking about a very small number of people. Across the world today, there are very few atheists in that sense. outside the post-Christian Western world, just about every nation, every tribe, every community believes in some sort of god or gods, and worships some sort of god or gods. Whether you're talking about animists, or whether you're talking about Hindus or Sikhs or Muslims or most varieties of Buddhists, they all believe that there are some unseen powers behind the scenes. Even in modern Britain, it's a very small minority of people who actually are prepared to say dogmatically there is no such thing as any god or power out there. Nobody's quite sure how many people would be prepared to say that. Some different opinion polls give different results according to how the question is phrased. But it's certainly a very small number of people who say dogmatically, there is nothing, there's nobody, there's no power out there beyond what we can see and measure and feel. And of course, in ancient times, there were even fewer people who would have taken that stance. It's very difficult, if not impossible, to find examples of people in ancient times, anywhere in the world, who denied the existence of any gods, any goddesses, any beings out there. The rarest of things, philosophical atheist in the ancient world. So if those are the people that David's talking about, if those are the people he labels fools, then he's talking about only a tiny number of people. But of course, as you read on through the psalm, it's obvious that he's not just talking about a tiny number of people, a little eccentric group like that. In fact, the opposite. It's obvious in this psalm that he's describing all human beings everywhere. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt, doing abominable iniquity. There is none who does good. God looks down from heaven on the children of man to see if there are any who do understand, who seek after God. And they have all fallen away. It seems that the fools he's talking about, the people who don't understand, who don't seek after God, well, these people aren't just a handful of people blogging away on atheist websites. He says these people are everywhere. In fact, he says more than that. He says all human beings fall into this category. All human beings left to themselves are fools. They're all saying in their hearts, there's no God. He's saying that's the universal attitude, the universal assumption of human beings, that there's no God. And that is deliberately maintained. They're saying in their hearts, there's no God. They're reassuring themselves and they're reassuring one another that there's no God. He's saying that's universally true of the human race. You see, when David talks in verse 1 about people denying that God exists, he's not talking like an anthropologist or a sociologist for whom the word God can mean any spiritual power, any invisible being. He's talking about the God of the Bible. He's talking about the real God. He's talking about the God of Genesis 1 to 3. His point is that people everywhere deny that that God exists. Not just that a God exists. Very few people do that. But he says people everywhere deny that the real God exists. The God whom we see in Genesis 1 to 3. The God whom we see across the Bible. And he says that's why they're fools. Because they refuse to believe in that God. The real God. Think about the God whom we see right there at the beginning of the Bible. He's eternal. In the beginning, God created. So he was there before the beginning. When all things, all other things began, God was already there. He's the eternal God. He's the self-existent God. He doesn't depend upon anything else. He's the one who calls all other things into being. He simply is. He's the creator of everything. He created the heavens. He created the earth. He creates all that's in them. He's distinct from creation. He's not part of creation. Creation isn't just an extension of him. And he's not an extension of it. He and the creation are two things. There's the creator and there's the creation. He called the heavens and the earth into being by his will, for his pleasure. There's no other reason why this universe exists except because he chose that it should exist and he spoke it into being. It's all for his glory, for his pleasure. And because it's his universe, because he called it all into being, he has total power over it. He is the omnipotent God. And because he stands outside it and creates it all, he knows it all perfectly. He knows all that there is in every detail because he created every detail. Genesis shows us this God's looking at everything he's made, seeing it all. God saw all that he had made, says the book. And this God then makes his power real throughout all creation. In that sense, he's present everywhere in his creation, controlling it, nurturing it, blessing it. And this God is beautiful. This God stamps his own beauty upon his creation, which is why it's so very good, why it's so beautifully structured and ordered, why it's all consistent, why there are regular laws. And this God gives commands. When he calls man into being, he makes it plain that he is the master and man is his servant. And he tells the human beings he has made what they are to do, how they are to spend their lives, how they are to spend 6 days, how they are to spend 1 day, what their duties are. He tells them that they are his creatures, his servants, made for him. 6 days they're to serve him by doing the work he's given them to do. 1 day they are to spend focusing on him alone, worshipping him. But in all things acknowledging that they exist for him, not he exists for them. And this God is a God who makes it plain that if people disobey his commands, he will punish them. I tell you what is good and evil. I set that tree there as a sign. And on the day you eat the fruit of that tree, the day you say, I will decide for myself what is good and evil, on that day you will die. This God is a God who imposes sanctions and who has sworn that he will bring those sanctions surely on those who disobey him. That's the God whom David is talking about here in this psalm. This infinite, eternal, all-powerful, supreme God to whom man is completely answerable. This God who works all things for his own glory. This God who makes demands on human beings, who claims 100% of their time, all of their energy, and who says, disobey me and you will die. So when David talks about fools who say, no God, what he's saying is that they refuse to believe in that God. And he says that is true of human beings everywhere. It's true of all human beings left to themselves, that they refuse to believe in that God. And they're fools not to believe in that God. It is an act of total irrationality not to believe in that God. Why? Well, because that God has written the facts about himself across the whole universe. To anybody who is willing to look at the world around them, who is willing to look at it with open eyes, it will be utterly evident that the world is not self-existent. It will be utterly evident that this world was created by that sort of God. Paul tells us in Romans chapter 1, what can be known about God is plain to men, because God has shown it to them. His invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. To look at this universe in all its beauty, its structure, its complexity, and then to say there is no infinite God, there is no eternal God, there's no all-powerful God, there's no glorious God, there's no beautiful God, is an act of utter irrationality. And not only has God written the evidence of himself across the universe, he's also, says Paul, written the evidence of himself across man's own being. He's put within us mysterious faculties. He's put within us a conscience, which tells us that some things are right and that some things are wrong. And that those who do wrong things deserve to be punished. And that they will be punished. A person who says that there's no God who is concerned about justice, there's no God who has given commands, is denying the evidence of his own being, his own conscience. He's a fool. He has to deny things that are self-evident. It's evident to every human being that God is there in his majesty and power. It's evident to every human being who looks inside himself that God is a God who cares about right and wrong, and who has said that sin deserves to be punished. A person who refuses to believe in such a God, a person who says that God doesn't exist, is a fool. He's irrational. I can't remember if I've ever read to you the testimony of J. Budziszewski. Did I ever talk to you about J. Budziszewski? Budziszewski is a professor of philosophy in the United States. He was brought up in a Christian home. He was brought up to believe in that God, the God we've been talking about, the God of the Bible. But in his 20s, he rejected it all. He shut that God out of his mind. He persuaded himself that that God could not exist. He argued that although God might exist, he would be irrelevant. I couldn't quite rule out the existence of God, but I thought I could rule out the existence of a God that mattered. In other words,
he ruled out the existence of the God of the Bible. The God who matters infinitely. The God who creates all things. The God who upholds all things. The God who will judge all men. He ruled out the existence of that God. But he knew that to do it, he would have to rule out other things. He'd have to rule out the reality of conscience. Because if he once accepted that there was such a thing as real right and real wrong, then he would have to accept that there was someone behind that who had written that sense of right and wrong onto his heart. And so he had to deny the very existence of right and wrong. When he took up his post lecturing at the University of Texas, he laid out his manifesto, what he intended to teach the young people in his care. Two things. The first was that we human beings just make up the difference between good and evil. He had to say that because he was determined not to accept that there was a God out there who had decided what was good and what was evil. And so he says, we must just make it up ourselves. And the second was that we aren't responsible for what we do anyway. Because if there's such a thing as real responsibility, there must be somebody who is planning to call us to account, somebody to whom we're responsible. Why? Why did he embrace that sort of philosophy? He says the reason was sheer mulish pride. I didn't want God to be God. I wanted J. Bud Zizewski to be God. I see that now, but I didn't see that then. He's determined to say to himself, to say in his heart, the God of the Bible doesn't exist. And so he has to deny things that he knows are true. Deep down he knows that there's such a thing as right and wrong. Deep down he knows that people are responsible for their actions. Deep down he knows that people who do wrong deserve to be punished. That's part of himself. It's written into his conscience. But he's got to deny it all. Listen to what he says. I've already said that everything goes wrong without God. This is true even of the good things he's given us, such as our minds. One of the good things I've been given is a stronger than average mind. He's a very bright man. I don't make the observation to boast. Human beings are given diverse gifts to serve him in diverse ways. The problem is that a strong mind that refuses the call to serve God has its own way of going wrong. When some people flee from God, they rob and kill. When others flee from God, they do a lot of drugs and have a lot of sex. When I fled from God, I didn't do any of those things. My way of fleeing was to get stupid. Though it always comes as a surprise to intellectuals, there are some forms of stupidity that one must be highly intelligent and educated to commit. God keeps them in his arsenal to pull down mulish pride. And I discovered them all. This is how I ended up doing a doctoral dissertation to prove that we make up the difference between good and evil, and that we aren't responsible for what we do. I remember now that I even taught these things to students. That's what he taught his students. There's no such thing as right and wrong. You're not responsible for anything you do. He says, now that's sin. It was also agony, he says. You cannot imagine what a person has to do to himself. Well, if you were like I was, maybe you can. What a person has to do to himself to go on believing such nonsense. St. Paul said that the knowledge of God's law is written on our hearts. Our conscience is also bearing witness. The way natural law thinkers put this is to say that they constitute the deep structure of our minds. That means that so long as we have minds, we can't not know them. Well, I was unusually determined not to know them. Therefore, I had to destroy my mind. I resisted the temptation to believe in good with as much energy as some saints resist the temptation to neglect good. For instance, I loved my wife and children, but I was determined to regard this love as merely a subjective preference with no real and objective value. Think what this did to my very capacity to love them. After all, love's a commitment of the will to the true good of another person. And how can one's will be committed to the true good of another person if he denies the reality of good, denies the reality of persons, and denies that his commitments are in his control? Visualize a man opening up the access panels of his mind and pulling out all the components that have God's image stamped on them. The problem is they all have God's image stamped on them. So the man can never stop. No matter how much he pulls out, there's still more to pull. I was that man. Because I pulled out more and more, there was less and less that I could think about. But because there was less and less that I could think about, I thought I was becoming more and more focused. Because I believed things that filled me with dread, I thought I was smarter and braver than the people who didn't believe them. I thought I saw an emptiness at the heart of the universe that was hidden from their foolish eyes. Of course, I was the fool. What a fool. What a fool. To look at his wife and to say, there's no such thing as good. So love. There's nothing good about loving. There's no such thing as a person with a real personality, real responsibilities. And there's no such thing as being committed to somebody. Because you're not responsible for what you do, so you can't choose to be committed to somebody. Imagine having to tear up all of that. But that's what he was determined to do. Because otherwise he would have had to accept the God of the Bible. He would have had to accept that there's a God out there who had made him and who had stamped on him this sense of right and wrong and who held him responsible for his actions. He was determined not to believe those things. And so he became a fool. The fool says in his heart, no God. Now, of course, most people aren't as bright as he was. Most people don't reason it all through intellectually and realize that what they're doing is deliberately driving out things that they know are true. But every person who denies that the God of the Bible is there, in the end, is doing the same thing. He's suppressing things that he knows are a fact. He's running away from truth. He's in denial. And the writer says, David says, that is true of all human beings everywhere. Let's just think about some of the different fools that you have in this world. There are the people who label themselves atheists. The people who simply look at the universe around them and say, it all just happened. That complexity is an illusion. It doesn't mean anything. And human beings have no value in the end, because they're just the product of random forces. They're no different in the end from any other assembly of molecules. They just happen to have come together in a slightly different pattern. That's the atheist. He's running away from the facts. From what he knows to be true. He can't live like that. If somebody murders his daughter, he can't actually say, well, it doesn't matter. It's just like treading on a worm. She didn't really have any value. She had no real purpose. He can't really deny the existence of human love and say it's valuable. He's running away. That's the atheist. But what about the idolater? What about the man who chooses to worship idols? And that's been the great majority of the human race down through the centuries. If you were to survey all the centuries of human history, the vast majority of human beings have willingly bowed down in front of things their hands have made. In other words, they're denying the real God. They're denying that God is infinite. They're denying that God is eternal. How can you say, God is eternal and I made him yesterday and covered him with silver? They're denying that God is all powerful. As Isaiah says, what do you think of a God whom you can carry around with you and who can't move unless you put him on a truck? They're denying the existence of a God who can see everything. You can turn the idol round and he can't see anything. Some people do that. They want to do something and they don't want God to know about it. Then they turn round the picture on the wall. They turn round the idol in the alcove. The idolater, he's a fool. The hypocrite. The person who says, oh yes, I worship this God. I've read about him in the Bible. I've heard him preached about in church. And yes, I'm fully convinced and I believe in him and I serve him. But who meanwhile hides away what he's really doing, what he's really feeling. He puts up a pretense. That man clearly doesn't believe, really believe in the God of the Bible, a God who knows everything, a God who can see the thoughts of our hearts as easily as he can see our outward actions. If a person really believed in the God of the Bible, if a person really believed that God can look into every cranny of the heart, you wouldn't even try to put up that sort of pretense, would you? The hypocrite's a fool. What about the nominalist? What I mean by that is the person who says, well, providing I join the club, providing I just, you know, belong and take the label of being a Christian, of being a God worshipper, then that'll do me. Lots of people are nominal worshippers of God, aren't they? They're christened, they're confirmed, they put down Christian or whatever religion it might be when they're filling out forms. But they don't believe that there's a God who's supremely important and who demands their obedience night and day and for whom they were created and who is going to call them to account. Otherwise they couldn't live as nominalists. They're in denial. What about the careless? The people who accept that God might be there. He probably is. You know. But they live as if he wasn't. Again, they don't really believe. They don't really believe in this God who made them for his own glory, who will certainly call them to account, who has fashioned them with intricate care, because what they do matters to him. They're fools. And what about the religious people? The people who say that they believe in a God who is good and holy, infinite, all-knowing, but who think that by their own religion, by their own good works, they can compensate him for their sins, for their disobedience. They're fools, aren't they? If they really were not in denial, when they looked at themselves, they would see that there are things they've done that have offended God so grossly that nothing they do could ever compensate. And they would abandon their self-righteousness. Do you see why the writer tells us that this denial of the real God is universal? Whether it shows itself by idolatry, or whether it shows itself by hypocrisy, whether it shows itself by nominal religion, whether it shows itself by complete carelessness, whether it shows itself by self-righteous works. Human beings everywhere are hiding from the fact that there is a God who is infinite, supreme, who demands total obedience, and who will judge them. Five points, very briefly, to finish. Five things that this psalm tells us. Number one, this determination not to believe in the real God is the cause of all human corruption. Pictures, human beings saying, there's no God. Closing their hearts to the real God, turning to their idolatry or their hypocrisy or their nominalism or their carelessness or their works religion. Pictures people denying the reality of who God is. And then he says they are corrupt. And they do abominable iniquity. And there is none who does good. They've all fallen away. Together they've become corrupt. There is none who does good, not even one. It's that way round. He looks at all the wickedness, all the corruption, all the moral horrors or the immoral horrors across the world. And he says, where do they all spring from? They spring from man's refusal to believe in God as he really is and to worship him as he really is. This determination not to believe in the real God is the cause of all moral corruption. Second thing he tells us is this, that this determination not to believe in the real God is the real reason for the world's hatred against God's people. Verse 4, have those who work evil no knowledge? Who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call upon God. They determined not to call upon the real God. And therefore they hate God's people. Because God's people are a constant reminder to them of the God whom they don't want to think about. They don't want to believe in. All through down through the centuries, God's people have been persecuted. And sometimes they've been persecuted with extraordinary rage. Why? Because this world, the people of this world, who are determined not to believe in the real God, are furious with people who speak about the real God. Third thing that the psalmist tells us is this, that this determination not to believe in the real God leads to a terrified insecurity and unhappiness. Verse 5, there they are in great terror where there is no terror. People don't want to believe in the reality of God. And they think that if they can push the thought of God out of their minds in any of the ways we've described, it will bring them security. They'll at last feel free. The opposite is true. Why do human beings live with such fear, such insecurity, such constant worrying? The answer is because they're running away. They're running away from the only one who can be real security for them. They have nothing They have no certainties. They have no hope. They have nothing on which they can rest because they've shut out the real, eternal, almighty God, the holy God. They don't want him. And that leaves them without any moorings. Fourthly, this determination not to believe in the real God provokes God himself to judge and punish. God scatters the bones of him who encamps against you. You put them to shame, for God has rejected them. We need to remember this and say it again and again, that man's greatest sin is not that he murders, not that he commits adultery, not that he steals. Man's greatest sin is that he says in his heart, there is no God. It's because of that, the basic sin, the foundation sin, that all these other sins follow on. And it's that sin supremely which provokes God to wrath and to judgment. And the fifth thing that this psalm tells us is this: that this determination not to believe in the real God can only be overcome by God's grace. He tells us it's universal. There is no one who does God good. God looks down from heaven on the children of man to see if there are any who understand, who seek after God, and they have all fallen away. Together they have become corrupt. He says this really is universal. It is true of every single human being on the earth today that by nature we're locked into this mindset, this determination not to know the truth, not to know the real God. And yet we do. David himself did. And what that means is that somebody must have broken in from outside. That somebody must have stepped in to reverse the irreversible, to change the unchangeable, to set David free from that unbreakable mindset. God himself, the great deliverer. God himself, who takes people who are blind, who are stubborn, who are saying in their hearts, no God, and who says, yes, I'm here, and who opens their eyes and changes their minds and makes them aware of himself. It's God's grace. He rescued Jacob Zizuski. He's rescued many of us here. There was a time when we lived, whatever we believed theoretically, there was a time when we lived as if the God of the Bible didn't exist. Some of us were hypocrites. Some of us were nominal Christians. Some of us were just careless. Some of us hid behind our good works religion. But we didn't believe in the God of the Bible. We didn't fear him. We didn't worship him. We didn't adore him. But God broke in. And God saved us. God turned us round. God gave us a real knowledge of himself. In the psalmist's day, when David wrote these words, there were only a few people for whom God had done that. David himself. Not one man here, one woman there, but the whole world. Oh, if you had looked across the nations of the world, how few people you'd have found whose eyes God had opened. And that's why the psalmist cries out in verse 6, oh, that salvation for Israel would come out of Zion. When God restores the fortunes of his people, let Jacob rejoice, let Israel be glad. David was looking forward to a day when the knowledge of the true God would break upon the world, when God would open the eyes of people to himself across the world. He was looking forward to the coming of Christ. He was coming, looking forward to the day when Christ would come to reveal God to men and women of all nations, when Christ's messengers would go through all the world, and when through their witness the eyes of countless people would be opened, when countless people would be brought to know what they had never known, to worship the one they had never believed in before. Today there are millions upon millions of people who have abandoned their idols and their hypocrisy and their nominalism and their carelessness and their do-good religions and their atheism. There are millions of millions of people who have had their eyes opened through Christ by the Spirit. And there'll be millions more. Because grace defeats this blindness. Grace changes people's hearts. Here in the Western world, oh, we're living in depressing days, aren't we? The vast majority of people seem so determined to say, not just in their hearts, but to say openly, the God of the Bible doesn't exist. But David assumes that that is the norm. David assumes that that's the universal. And David believes that God can save. That God can save people like that. And David prayed for the day when it would happen. And we are living in the days when it is happening. And we can pray that it will happen more and more widely and more wonderfully.